The streetlights come on. It's getting dark. She's supposed to be home before the streetlights come on. She wasn't home yet, so I'm thinking she's just out there playing with a friend. She never came home.
She should be playing with a friend. She should be going to school and enjoying herself. Not strangled, murdered, and treated like a piece of garbage.
Seeing her laying there smoldering has tore you up. It's one of those cases that never leave you. And Stanley's making sure of that.
There's no doubt whatsoever in my mind or heart that they have the right man.
He looked at and or processed 10,000 items of evidence and never found anything that connected Jennifer and Stanley.
I mean, I like cheese, but I'm not a rat. I like kids, but not like that.
You're listening to Suspect Convictions, a podcast from WVIK and Scott Reeder. I'm Lacey Scarmana. At the end of last summer, Scott came to me with this story. He told me about being at Jefferson Elementary School the night police found the body of 9-year-old Jennifer Lewis, and he told me about the complicated legal process that ensued. Over the past 9 months or so, we've dug deeper into the case against Stanley Liggins, leading up to his third trial. But we recently found out that this case has taken yet another turn. The trial has been delayed once again. So this is the last episode of Suspect Convictions Season 1, and it's a long one, but we still have a lot of new information to share. We'll visit three important places in this story: a courthouse, a jail, and a schoolyard. First up, in April, we went to the third floor of the Scott County Courthouse in Davenport, Iowa, for a hearing. Stanley Liggins had filed a motion to fire his defense team. 7th Judicial District Chief Judge Marlita Grieve opened the hearing.
Good morning. We're here today in the matter of the State of Iowa versus Stanley Liggins, case number FECR 147696. We're here today for oral argument on Mr. Liggins' motion to withdraw counsel. It was filed on April 6, 2017 by Derek Jones. I also have received and reviewed a letter from Mr. Liggins that was dated, or at least it was filed on April 4th of 2017. And I have reviewed the resistance that was filed by the state on April 17th of 2017. So, Mr. Jones.
Good morning, Your Honor.
Morning.
Mr. Liggins directed me to file a motion requesting substitute counsel. We have had, I believe, a complete breakdown in the attorney-client relationship at this point. I think the state's citations as to the case law in this area are accurate. There are two bases under the law, I believe, apply here that would suggest substitute counsel is appropriate. One would be an irreconcilable conflict between Mr. Liggins and myself. The second ground would be a complete breakdown in communication between the two of us. I believe Mr. Liggins wishes to address the court today and kind of explain things from his perspective. I can tell the court that Mr. Liggins and I do have significant disagreements about pretrial and trial strategy.
Derek Jones went on to say that at the end of the day, Stanley Liggins is entitled to effective counsel. And after the previous lead attorney on the case, Phil Ramirez, had to step down because of his cancer diagnosis, Derek and Stanley had significant disagreements on how to progress.
I don't see how we can move forward effectively, and I don't believe there's a way we can reconcile the conflict at this point. The relationship's been too damaged. We've made efforts to try to resolve the problem. They've been unsuccessful. I think appointing substitute counsel is appropriate. I'd ask you to let Mr. Liggins address the court to explain from his point of view his concerns. I might have some follow-up comments based on that.
Mr. Liggins.
Thank you, Your Honor. Excuse me. I wrote down a few things I wanted to present. Excuse me. Well, when this case first started, when Mr. Jones and Phil was appointed to this case, I told him exactly what direction I wanted to go and we agreed upon a lot of things, and Phil and Derek, we all talked about it, and everything was worked out. But when Phil got sick, Derek took over, and he decided to change everything that we talked about, and he changed it without letting me know exactly what he was changing. I was surprised by it, and I tried to get back on the right track with him, but, you know, he really dismissed everything that I said and basically told me that everything that we talked about was really worthless and not worth his time, and he didn't want to waste his time with it.
Stanley brought up the missing 77 police reports that have been discovered since his first two trials.
And I felt like it was more, and come to find out, it is more. And that's what this really is about, the newly discovered evidence that was found with regard to the 1,700 pages that was withheld by the state. And I think it's still more. And we were supposed to add all of that to the motion to dismiss, and Derek changed his mind for some reason, and he won't tell me what it is. But a lot of those reports really show misconduct on the state's part, and there's no way they can get around it. They can't blame it on me. They can't blame it on my my attorneys. They can't blame it on the cops. It was in their hands, and that's what I was intending to prove, that it was in their hands. It was in Bill Davis's hands, Julie Walton's, and Grubesich's hands. And so one of my, may I have some water, please? One of the strategies was to add Bill Davis, Julie Walton, and Joseph Grubesich to the witness list, and we did that over a year ago. And for some reason, that looked like, as far as Julie, hasn't been honored. She's still a part of the witness list, and she's still been arguing motions, writing motions up, and that haven't been really pursued too much by Derek to find out why, Julie is still arguing this case now.
Stanley said he doesn't trust Derek Jones' motives and doesn't understand why he won't introduce the evidence Stanley claims to have.
I gave him all of my reports with respect to the newly discovered evidence, and he wouldn't return them to me. And he held them for like a year or so. And the more that he wouldn't return them to me, the more I wanted them. That made me think it was something there, because he wouldn't give them back. I asked him why he wouldn't give them back. He said that they was misplaced. But how could they be misplaced when they was in his computer? So I feel like he lied to me. And so I wrote him a letter asking him, you know, why he wouldn't return my stuff. And I asked him, was he helping the county attorney's office? You know, he said he wasn't, but I don't know if he is or not. And I asked him, was he doing this because he wanted to become a judge or something? And he admitted that he did want to be a judge, and I told him I hope he get there, but, you know, I don't want him stabbing me in the back to get there. And he said that's not what he's doing, but I really don't know what he's doing, but I have no trust in him anymore. I think he's been lying to me, and like I said, there's a lot of newly discovered evidence that we found so far, that besides the 77, that clearly shows misconduct on a state's part, and I feel like that should have been argued in February, and it wasn't.
Stanley wrapped up his comments by recognizing the unusual circumstances of his case.
I hope you grant this motion. I'm not stalling or anything like that. That's not what I'm doing. I'm tired of sitting in this jail. I'm tired of coming up here. I know y'all tired of seeing me. The feeling is mutual. I just want to be represented right. You know, I want to make sure everything goes right. Everything that we have now, I didn't have in the first or second trial because they withheld it from me. And I finally got an opportunity to present everything that I need to present. And I don't have the right attorney on it. I thought I did, but I think he's capable of doing it, but something's holding him back. And I have no idea what it is. It's something, but maybe you can ask him what it is, but he won't tell me. I guess that's it. I hope I'm making a little sense. I'm a little nervous. I'm kind of cold. All right, but I think that's it.
In response, Scott County Attorney Mike Walton began by saying Stanley Liggins has no grounds for firing his defense team.
I think the law in this regard is fairly clear, and that is what is important here is not necessarily Mr. Liggins' relationship with his lawyer, but that he get a fair trial. And the focus is on the adversarial process, not on his relationship with his attorney. It's clear that Mr. Liggins wants to call the shots in this case, and that isn't always possible. When he asks what is holding Mr. Jones back, it may very well be the evidence. He makes vague references to newly discovered evidence. I don't know of any. I don't believe there is any. I don't believe there's anything new that's been produced unless it was a new investigation. He's not happy with the way things are going. That's clear. That's not his lawyer's fault. I think this court is well aware of Mr. Jones's and Mr. Puente's work ethic.
And Mike Walton urged the court to keep the victim in mind when ruling on this motion.
As the cases say, it's not just Mr. Liggins' concerns here. Justice delayed is justice denied for the state and the victims as well. Certainly justice has been delayed in this case. It's been 3 years since this matter was reversed. I say at every hearing, and I think it's important that this be on the record, that those delays have never been attributable to the state, that the state has been prepared to go to trial. The state has never missed a deadline and continues to try to move this case forward, including discovery, cooperation with discovery. I don't think we've ever denied a discovery request. I don't think we've ever denied a scheduling of a date for deposition or review of evidence or anything else. The public has an interest in the prompt and efficient administration of justice, certainly in this case. Hundreds of hours have been put forth to try this case on May 22nd. In a typical case, this may not be last minute, but in this case, this is last minute. This case has been around 3 years. We are ready to go to trial on May 22nd. To end this case at this point would result in an enormous waste of time that has been expended. Again, for no guarantee that anything's going to change with new counsel. He has not alleged sufficient cause to fire his counsel or substitute counsel, and this case should proceed forward to trial on May 22nd as scheduled.
And Stanley had a chance to respond to the prosecutor's comments.
I'm not stalling. That's not what I'm doing here. I just want a fair trial, and I've been guaranteed a fair trial for over almost two decades now. I haven't received a fair trial yet. And Mr. Walton alluding to this new discovered evidence that their claim is non-existent. That's what we was planning on proving in February, this new evidence. And we have it, and we're going to prove it. And y'all know exactly what it is. You know some of it, but I know exactly what it is. And we're going to prove it. We're going to prove everything that you did and everything that was said, particularly Julie Walton, Bill Davis, and Grubesich. We're going to prove that. That's going to happen. But I can't prove it going forward with the attorney I have now, because for some reason he don't want to present it.
Jennifer's godmother, Mary Maxwell Rockwell, was in the courtroom for every single pretrial hearing.
Made him real again, I guess. You know, up until then, I've only heard him say, you know, yes, Your Honor, or possibly state his name. And for him to be able to say what he was feeling, his reasons for wanting the judge, I just felt like it was the circus and pony show. Again, he can get up there and say whatever he wants. He's the accused. He has that right. And I believe in that right. But actually hearing his voice after almost 27 years, I just felt like I got punched in the gut.
Chief Judge Grieve ruled on the motion later that day. The ruling states, in this court's experience, Mr. Jones has always been a well-respected attorney, a hard worker, and a zealous advocate for his clients. Despite all of these reasons, the court feels it has no choice but to grant this motion. Mr. Jones's statements that his relationship with Mr. Liggins is toxic and that the attorney-client relationship has completely broken down are the two hurdles the other facts cannot overcome and which show justifiable dissatisfaction to warrant substitution of counsel. Elsewhere in the ruling, Judge Grieve states it could conceivably take another year before different attorneys are familiar enough with this case to go to trial. This came as a shock to Mary Rockwell.
I just feel like, like I was getting ready to skydive and they started pushing me out of the plane and then they just grabbed me and pulled me back and said, not yet. You know, it's just like the nerves get right to the top, the emotions are right to the top. You're right back where we were 27 years ago when I got the call.
She believes Stanley is playing the system.
I think that's part of it, too. The longer he drags it on, the less witnesses are alive. That's, you know, and that's to his advantage because they get some proxy up there to read a statement. That's not the same as a big old seasoned police officer breaking down in tears when he's talking about what he had to do. You know, I think he's playing the waiting game. He's trying to pull as much emotion out of it as he can.
Judge Grieve appointed the state public defender's office to represent Stanley Liggins at the state's expense. After the ruling, we caught up with former Scott County Attorney Bill Davis, who prosecuted Stanley Liggins' first two trials.
Well, it's my understanding that the public defender's office out of Blackhawk County, Waterloo, has been assigned to the case, and they have already had discussions about moving Stanley to Blackhawk County, and that would be all well and good, and nobody'd resist except Scott County is not willing to pay $50 a day to house Stanley in another jail, and it would amount to about $18,000 if the trial does take a year to come to fruition, and that's what I've learned this morning.
As for the motions that have already been ruled on, Bill Davis says most of the decisions will carry over to the next trial.
Well, all of the motions to date that have been ruled on by Judge Grieve without prejudice, meaning that they can be brought up again. However, it's not just going to be a blanket start over. If there's something that they want readdressed, they have the right to do that, and the court will, of course, hear it. Because that's the way she left all of the rulings. So that's available. But don't look for this trial just to start over as to motions.
And despite the help he's given the current prosecutors, Bill says he respects and understands Judge Grieve's ruling.
I was very surprised. However, I wasn't present for the arguments. And after I heard what Mr. Jones advised the court, I don't know that Marlita had much of a choice. I shouldn't be calling Chief Judge by her first name. But the Chief Judge, I think, was boxed in, especially with the history of this case. And when you have the lawyer saying, I cannot work with him, we cannot communicate, and what choice does she have?
And Stanley Liggins' defense attorney from the second trial, Mike Toby, says the judge is being careful.
Judge Grieve, certainly like any judge now and everybody else, thinks this ought to be the last time this case has to be tried. So it's got to be really right. I do not want to build in any claim of error on anyone's part, mine, trial counsel, anyone. And so there's going to be a little more flexibility. But I think that's the only reason that more flexibility time-wise might need to be granted. You might almost look at it as perhaps an insurance policy.
The next hearing in this case is scheduled for January 3rd, 2018, and then the court will schedule a new date for the trial to begin. As Judge Greaves' ruling stated, it could take up to a year for the new public defenders to be ready to try this case. In the meantime, Stanley Liggins is still awaiting trial in the Scott County Jail. The jail is in the same building as the courthouse, two floors down from where all these hearings took place. For the second part of our story, Scott Reeder, our producer Alfredo Monteca, and I took a tour of the jail to see what Stanley Liggins' life has been like for the past 3 years.
Can I get 3 escorted tags, please? I'm going to go over with you guys. I have to do this for anybody that enters our jail. This is a sexual assault awareness form for PREA, Prison Rape.
That's Captain Stephanie Burnett, interim captain of the Scott County Jail.
You are here on one of our busiest days of the week, Friday. We have prison trips go out. We have just a lot of court movement. It's just end of the week, a lot of bailiffs in and out, just the judges, people turning themselves in for the weekend. We are a behavior-based facility, so our jail is based on when you walk into the door, how your behavior is. You could be in here on murder first, and if you have good behavior and you're not protected custody, you could go all the way upstairs to general population, which means you can walk these hallways without a staff member. That's what our jail is designed for, direct supervision, behavior based.
So how has his behavior been?
He's a very well behaved inmate. I don't believe he's ever been written up. No, I got the key. Okay. So Stanley would have been brought in to our facility through these two doors. That's the entrance sally port for vehicles. He would have been brought in by, who? I think it was DOC, and I don't know if it was our transporting officer that picked him up, and then they wait for us to open the door, and then he walks into here. Okay? You can come into here. So we have booking officers that book in every inmate and ask them several questions. There'll be mental health questions, medical questions, where they lived, that type of stuff, their charges. And once they're done with the booking procedure, they could be fingerprinted. And then if they have good behavior, they sit out there. If there's a reason, whether it's medical or protective custody, that type of thing, they might go into a holding cell. I can't answer what he did. I think he's been here about 3 years. So it is unusual to have someone in our jail for that long. And every inmate that comes into our jail, they if they aren't fingerprinted, they do get a mugshot taken, every one of them. We have two classification officers that classify our inmates that would have, you know, classified Mr. Liggins to his housing. He has moved throughout the housing unit he's in, but he's always been an intake since he's been incarcerated here. And he's been satisfied with that. I've never received any complaints. I don't think I've ever seen any write-up on him. So he follows the rules. His room is always very clean. When we inspect it, he's, I would say, probably one of the least problematic inmates we have. He is currently in a cell where there's two cells, so there would be one other inmate that he has contact with. But he has been moved around where there's a cell with four, so he would have contact with three other inmates. They wake up at 5 a.m. They have a formal, they get razor pass during the weekdays, so he can get his razor, wake up at 5 a.m., shower, and then they lock down and do a formal standing head count at the end of the night shift at about 5:45 to 6 a.m. So then they go back to their rooms, and then they wait for day shift to come back in, and they stand up and do another formal standing head count, and they're unlocked again. Breakfast is served about 6:20. He would receive his breakfast and eat in the sub-day room of his housing unit, eat breakfast, clean up. They get the cleaning gear. He more than likely probably cleans his cell with a, they get a mop, a broom, sprays and cleaners, disinfectant, and he probably does clean his room, makes his bed very well because his room is always very tidy and clean. And then he sits out and he pretty much watches TV and reads books. And I don't know, you know, probably looks at his legal work. I'm guessing on that. He can order commissary, so he has access to do that. And there's access to vending machine, pop machine, microwave out there. So he's able to do that throughout the day. And they lock down at, they have lunch at about 12:20, eat lunch, and then they lock down at 1:30 for quiet time, 1:30 to 3. After 3, they're unlocked, and it's the same thing. TV, he can use the vending machine. They do get recreation twice a week. So he can go out and use the rec yard, walk around, exercise, and he has options for that.
That's all indoor, right?
It is indoor. When I show you through housing control, there's lighting that comes down through, like a skylight, so they do see natural light. They lock down at night and intake at 9 p.m. They have laundry pass during the week, so he gets clean laundry. They have access to shower every day. You know, he doesn't complain. He doesn't ask for programming, which he could. I actually have our program coordinator right here. I don't know if you want to talk to him. I'm putting him on the spot, though, if I do. Can I ask you one question, Paul?
Yeah.
Hi. You are on recording. Yes. They just want to know
whether Stanley Liggins is participating in any of the programming that's offered here.
Does he ever ask you for anything?
Yes. I take him books, really, really nice biographies, and I take him paper. I spend some time talking with him, but
I wasn't too sure. I didn't think he liked much.
He doesn't, and you know he's had a couple of cellmates.
Does he get along with?
Yeah. He is a model inmate.
I told him that.
Unfortunately, he's just really institutionalized, and he knows how to do it, and he just keeps to himself. So,
kind of biographies does he like?
Well, I've given him everything from the latest one. All of our stuff is donated. The latest one was a B.B. King. It was an autobiography. And from B.B. King to Doris Day and anything in between, he just likes reading about, you know, real-life stuff, real-life people. So.
How is the relationship that you have with Stanley?
I have a really good relationship with him, I think. I mean, we get along fine. He appreciates what we do. He's always really open to talking to me. I mean, he's not somebody I am scared of or tries to threaten me or anything like that. He's get along fine with him. I think he appreciates what we do.
Thank you.
Better than it with his lawyers, I think.
Yeah, there you go.
Thank you.
Family does not ask for much. We have a process of inmate grievances, and so in the 3 years that he has been here, I don't believe that I've seen any grievances from him. So inmate rights, you know, they have several rights, mm-hmm. and he has never complained or really written a grievance.
Is that pretty uncommon, too?
Yes. Well, I'm going to take you into housing control, which overlooks intake housing, where Mr. Liggins is housed. And because you guys don't have a camera, I can kind of explain to you where he's located. Okay, so if you see to the right there, the gentleman's rubbing his head right there, That is Mr. Liggins. Okay?
What on earth is he doing?
He's probably putting lotion on.
Oh, okay.
So, yep, he's putting lotion on. He He has a bed, he has a sink, a toilet, and I think his cell is ADA. So it's got like the extra bar, you know, handicapped accessible. He doesn't have a wheelchair or anything like that. It's always clean. He has, I think, two totes in there where he keeps his legal work. As you can see, there's two doors there. That's his little sub day room. There's a flat screen TV you're unable to see up in the corner. And that little table there, there's two chairs. He comes out there in the day room, sub day room there, and watches TV throughout the day, or he reads in his room. At 10 a.m. every day, the inmates are locked out of their cells. So he probably comes out, reads, or watches TV at that time.
Why do you do that? Just curious.
Because we don't want the inmates to be in their bed sleeping, which they try to do. We want them to be, if you let them sleep all day, they're up all night screaming and yelling and keeping the ones that want to participate in programs and follow the rules. If you let them sleep all day, they're up all night screaming and yelling. And then it upsets several of the other inmates that are following the rules who can't sleep. So there's strict rules. He doesn't complain, so I think he's just kind of used to this. I don't know that he likes it here. I've asked him, what do you think of it here? And, you know, he likes it. Every once in a while, we'll have a cleaning contest, and he typically, his little sub-day room will win, and they get popcorn, so.
How does this compare to a prison?
Since I don't work in a prison, I really can't tell you, but mostly prisons, my understanding, are big, big open areas with a lot more inmates, and it's a lot more dangerous, and he would be in a max security prison because of his charges, and I think they have access to a whole lot more stuff than the jail gives. And I think a jail is a little more restrictive than a prison. But again, I don't work in a prison. I haven't ever toured a prison to really answer you. The difference, obviously, between a jail and a prison normally would be you stay a year or less and you're out. But because of his case, he's been here much longer.
Sure. So I guess that would be another difference of the prison, is that inmates here in the county jail can, for example, he hasn't been outside in 3 years? Is that?
Yeah, he has not been outside. Mm-mm. We do open those windows in the spring and we close those in the fall so they get the fresh air coming in. You can see those windows are open right now. So he gets fresh air. Working here for 18 years, you are taught, no matter how horrific the crime may be, you do not prejudge any inmate. So as difficult as that may be for some, you treat the inmate with respect, and they will typically treat you back with respect. If you look at an inmate and you prejudge them with their charges, you can't work here. You can't look at the charge and then say, I'm going to mistreat you now. You would be fired. You can't do that. Inmates have rights. You know, there's state law, federal laws. You know, you have a duty to protect your inmates. And if you disobey any of those rules, and me as the interim captain, if any of my staff were to do that based on the charges of any of these inmates, they would be disciplined. I've heard the stories about Stanley, you know, years and years ago, how he behaved, and it's just shocking to me that he's who he is now. You do find that as people mature, they get really tired of the younger generation that are loud, and they just go to their room and say, I just need to get away from the loudness. I just want it to be quiet. Stanley Liggins, from the beginning, when we received him, until now, has had no discipline reports to date. He is what I would consider probably one of our most easygoing inmates. He asks for very little. He doesn't cause any issues. I've not seen any reports on him. He just follows the rules, knows what's needed and expected of him.
That description of Stanley Liggins is so different than anything else we've heard while reporting on this case. And it's certainly a stark contrast to Stanley's behavior in jail from more than two decades ago. But as Captain Burnett said, attitudes and behavior change quite a bit as people age. In fact, a lot has changed in the nearly 27 years since Stanley Liggins was arrested for the murder of Jennifer Lewis. I wasn't born yet. Our producer Alfredo was still living in Spain. And Scott was a brand new reporter in the Quad Cities. For the third part of our story, the three of us went to Jefferson Elementary School, about a mile away from the jail, to reflect on the time that has gone by and how we still don't have closure in this case.
I remember pulling up to Jefferson that night. I had the two radios in my car, one for the going to the newsroom and one monitoring the police traffic. And pulling up right about here. And it was just... The way I remember it is there was a Davenport police car right in front of me. And I got out of the car about the same time as the patrolman. And if you looked across the field here, you could see smoke rising on the edge of the playground. There was some taller grass. You saw where the playground ended and a vacant lot began. We just walked over there. The train's changed a little bit, but why don't we walk over there? And of course now there's a fence around the school playground. Back in those days there wasn't a fence. I guess that kind of reflects how this community has changed as well. Let's walk on over here to the area where I saw the fire that night. The terrain has changed a great deal over the last 27 years. They built a new social service agency across the street called the Friendly House, and they put a parking lot here where the Jennifer was found that night.
But I don't know, it's just so strange to me that this, like, there's a whole center across the street. They've reshaped the landscape, they've redone everything. Mm-hmm. My entire lifetime has gone by, yeah. And we're no closer than we were when he was originally charged.
Yeah, that's right. It's frustrating. I mean, it's frustrating that... When will there be justice for Jennifer Lewis is the question that comes to my mind. I mean, I'm not presuming guilt or innocence on anybody. I'm just asking when are we going to see justice for that little girl? I mean, right now, nobody stands convicted in that case.
And justice, and do you think we are going to learn the truth?
No.
Why?
Okay. Well, I don't think that trials are really about discovering truth. I think trials are about analyzing selective facts. So when I hear people in the court say, "Do you swear to tell the truth, the whole truth, nothing but the truth, so help you God?" It always gives me pause because they aren't hearing the whole truth. They're just hearing some of the facts. So, no, I don't think that we're going to ever hear the whole truth. We're going to hear some of it. The portion that our legal system allows us to hear.
So do you think it's possible to have justice for Jennifer then?
Well, I could give you a lawyer answer and ask the question, what is justice?
Do it. What is justice?
I think justice can be presented in a lot of different ways. You can get justice in a court of law in some ways. I think you can get justice in a podcast or a newspaper article or a radio broadcast. When people are brought up to speed on what is happening, I think you can get justice when a person is remembered for who they were, and not just the good things that happened in their lives, but the bad things too. I think you can get justice when whoever committed this crime or whoever assisted in this crime is held to accounts.
Jennifer's godmother, Mary Maxwell Rockwell, considers herself justice-minded.
I always have the ability to see both sides very clearly. You know, devil's advocate. You know, if I was Mr. Liggins and I had an open checkbook and the rest of my life, I would be doing the same thing he is. I don't condone it, but I understand it. Yeah, you know, right is right and wrong is wrong, and I know there's gray areas. But I guess I'm getting frustrated at, when does this end for us? When is it we know he's done, he's not getting out, we're not going to court? And I know, I don't think we'll ever get to that point. And I think that in itself is terrifying. The comment was made, we will be done when he draws his last breath.
And she believes that's the moment, that there will finally be justice for Jennifer.
I feel I know the truth, and I feel the truth will be revealed and dealt with when Stanley leaves this life. That's my own personal religious conviction, that really there's only three beings that know the truth, one being the accused, one being the murder victim, and the other one being our Lord. I feel I know the truth. But I wasn't there. There's no doubt in my mind that it's the truth. But the truth will come out, if not in this lifetime, when he passes on. I feel he will be held accountable, regardless what the courts here do.
Jennifer's mother, Sherry McCormick, still wants a one-on-one conversation with Stanley Liggins.
And I know if I look at him right in his face, I don't think he can handle it. I don't, because he's never ever. I just feel that the man didn't kill Jennifer, sexually assault her. He could look at me in my face and say, Sherry, I didn't do that. I didn't do that to Jennifer. And he did. I'm not going to let him get away with it. He's not. He's going to rot in hell.
For Mary, the most important thing is that Jennifer Lewis's story is being told.
I don't want her to be forgotten. You know, the court system hasn't forgot about her. But I want her family and her friends to remember her in a positive light, because the majority of her existence has been about her death. And just keep fighting.
This podcast is committed to covering the Stanley Liggins case when it eventually comes to trial, and Scott Reeder will produce a second season of Suspect Convictions, looking at a possible wrongful conviction case this fall. And over the summer, there will be an arc examining several criminal cases. Make sure you're subscribed to the podcast and like the Suspect Convictions Facebook page so you will be aware of these updates. A huge thanks to our producer, Alfredo Montega. And thank you to Colin Thompson and Cast Media for our online presence. And of course, thank you for listening to the first season of Suspect Convictions. Stay tuned for future updates.